we're going to read is going to be Mid-Pacific Serenity. Will be read by Bob W. from Hawaii. And then Bob will be introducing the author, which is Tom C. from Hawaii.
Hello?
Bob?
Yes. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. I'm an addict in recovery, and my name is Bob. And I have the honor today to read a story in the basic text, Mid-Pacific Serenity. Started off as a sponsee relationship with this man and turned into a beautiful relationship. So I'm really honored to read this. So Mid-Pacific Serenity, here we go. I am a happy, grateful addict, clean by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. Life today is fulfilling and there is a joy in my heart. It wasn't always that way. I drank and used drugs for 12 years on a daily basis, for 10 of them. I was an addict of the hopeless variety. It really seems to me that I was born this way. I was born and raised in Southern California in a loving, middle-class family. Both my sister and I were wanted, loved children and were shown that in every way. As far back as I can remember, I have felt separate from this family and all of life. Of course, I'm talking of an intense fear of life. I cannot remember feeling the simplicity of being a child. I had the addict's personality grown up, self-will run riot. I always wanted my own way, and if I didn't get it, I sure let everyone know. Growing up in Southern California, I seemed to get into all the normal things, going to the beach, getting into sports, yet always the fears and feelings of inadequacy never let me live up to my potential. I was an average student throughout school. I had lots of friends, yet I withdrew, dominated by fear. I guess I was about 15 when I tried my first drug, alcohol. From the first drink, it was oblivion. Finally, I'd found freedom from fear, or so I thought. From the beginning, I identified with the rejects, the people who slept on the beach under the piers. As I look back over these 12 years, I see how I loved each new drug I tried. Alcohol was only the beginning. If it got you loaded, I wanted to try it, and I always wanted more. It didn't matter if it was sniffing glue or shooting the best coke or heroin. I wasn't a rich, choosy addict. I just needed to stay high, and all my energy was put into that direction. I quit school in the 12th grade. Surfing had become a part of my life, so I was off to Hawaii. My parents were very confused about their son, who didn't do a very good job of hiding his desperation. To all who were sane and living life, I appeared very lost and unhappy. You see, it was a very short time after I started using that alcohol and drugs quit doing for me what they did in the beginning. The fear had returned, only much worse than before. My first trip to Hawaii was in 1962. Was only the beginning of many more to come. Always trying to run from myself. Hawaii was and is a paradise, but I only saw it through the eyes of being loaded. Thanks to the warm weather, it was easy to pursue the only life I knew. The way of life was to wander the streets and sleep in parked cars or other available shelters. At the age of 19, I was back in Hawaii for the third time, a full-blown addict. And so lost and confused, I only knew I had to drink and use drugs, and there was no other way. Returning to California at the end of the summer of 1963, I found myself joining the Navy. Being lost, that seemed to be the easiest thing to do, just sign my name. It was easier than looking for a job. I was so burned out already and wanted something different, yet didn't know how to ask for help. The Navy, of course, was not the answer. The drugs continued, and after 2 years, I was discharged. The psychiatrist said my mind had become disordered from the use of marijuana and LSD. Plus, I had jumped overboard in a rage at the Navy. I convinced myself that once I got out of the Navy, things would be different. No one would be telling me what to do. But I met a new friend at this point, the world of fixing. That was in 1965, and the next 6 years were the worst years of my life. As I see it today, those years got me into the program. After getting out of the Navy, I got married. How and why this woman married me is a mystery even today. On our wedding night, I shot some dope and slept on Venice Beach with my dogs. This is the type of behavior a selfish, self-centered addict has, concerned only with himself and getting loaded. The way I was able to stay loaded was by dealing, always being the middleman. The house where we lived was being watched. It was on the Venice Canal in Venice, California. My parents knew what was going on. So with my wife 4 months pregnant, they helped us get out of there, and it was back to Hawaii. We lived on the North Shore. It was a more isolated part of Oahu. Lots of young people lived there. This was the year 1967, and at this time, LSD was really popular, and everyone was into the spiritual thing. Eastern religion and gurus. There were two Harvard professors who were taking LSD, saying that you could find God. So I thought all that love, peace, and joy sounded good. I wanted out of the feelings that I was having. Fear dominated my life. I had been shooting a lot of speed in California the past year. I decided to clean up my life in Hawaii. So I took psychedelics, smoked hashish, and tried to meditate. Somewhere I had read that when the student was ready, the teacher would appear. Little did I know that the program of Narcotics Anonymous was about to be introduced to me and that it would become my teacher. I was able to stay away from shooting dope that year. My wife and I had a baby girl and were on welfare living in the country. I seemed to be fitting right into the movement of the time. Flower children, that everything is beautiful consciousness, yet still inside everything wasn't beautiful. There was a 4-bedroom house next door to us for rent. And one day this woman appeared and told us that God had told her that she was supposed to live there. She was in her 50s, had long gray hair to her waist, and wore a bikini most of the time. She had no money, but said she was led to this house. This woman seemed to radiate a feeling of love and joy that I had never felt from anyone else before. Immediately upon meeting her, I felt as if I had known her forever. Something in me was drawn to her. Little did I know that she was to become my sponsor and play such a big part in my life. This was the beginning of a journey that even today amazes me. It is a way of life, a way of learning complete trust in a higher power. Through a series of miracles, which I now have come to see quite normal to my life, this woman ended up in this house with the rent paid every month. Needless to say, this house became a program house. A meeting was started at the house. It was called the Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Traveling Group. and through the years it has traveled throughout the United States from Hawaii to the East Coast and through Europe twice, always attracting the addict who still suffers, offering a way up and out. I remember my first meeting at this house in 1968. For the first time, I felt I really belonged. Not so much because I heard people talk of using drugs as I had, but because they spoke of what was going on inside. For the first time, I found out that other people had fears also. Yet with all the hope this meeting brought me, it was only the beginning of a 3-year period that I would not want to live through again. I identified from the first meeting and wanted a new way of life. I would stay clean for a short period, then I would use again. First, I would just pick up a beer or smoke a joint, but I would always end up shooting dope again. I couldn't understand it then. Today, I realized that I still had reservations. There was still that thought that I could use. In the year 1970, I stayed clean for 3 months, 2 different times. The last time was right before Christmas. I smoked 2 joints and went into convulsions. After that, I took 2 downs once, and that was it. For almost an entire year, I didn't know what it was to be clean again. I drank, took pills, and shot cocaine and heroin daily. Living on the North Shore made it easy to stay out of trouble. There weren't many police in that area. I stayed loaded, my wife left, and I knew I would never stay clean again. One time I ran out of dope and I shot several 100 milligrams of caffeine tablets and went into the shakes for hours. I seemed to be so desperate to die. Although I never woke up in the gutter or on Skid Row, I woke up on the beach under a palm tree with my face in the sand. The feelings were the same. Skid Row is in the mind. I really feel that it doesn't matter what or how much we use, where we live, or how much money we have. It's what's going on inside that counts. For me, I knew I was dying, but still couldn't stop. I'd given up on NA. Everyone I knew in the program had left. My sponsor and a group of clean addicts were in Europe, and one of the clean addicts was living on another island and would call every so often to see if I was still alive. On the morning of October 20th, 1971, I woke up with dope in the house, and for some reason, I walked out to the beach and didn't get loaded the moment I opened my eyes. I remember it was a gray, overcast day and I was feeling hopeless. I just sat on the beach crying, just wanting to die. I couldn't go on. A feeling went through me that I never experienced before in my life. I felt warm and peaceful inside. A voice said, "It's over. You never have to use again." I felt a peace I had never felt before. I returned to the house, packed some of my stuff, and headed for the airport. I was going to the island of Maui, where my clean friend was. My recovery started with miracles. I had no money, yet I was led to the right places at the right times, and I got to Maui. I walked in and told him I was ready to go to any lengths to stay clean. Staying clean today goes a long way beyond not taking that first fix, pill, or drink. It is a way of life, a life that I call an adventure. I have an outline for living. It is the 12 steps of NA. I either practice and live these steps or I die. I really believe that a person who stays clean for any amount of time is staying clean through periods when it seems to make no sense to stay clean. I feel we all have felt like that at one time or another. I've stayed clean by the grace of God. The steps have become my life. I have had to take many inventories, the fourth and fifth steps, and I will continue to have to write down what is going on inside and give it away. For me, this is the way it works. Keep giving away the old and making room for the new. For me, it never gets really easy to do. Usually I have to be backed up against the wall and humiliated, and then I share. They say that this is a program of action, that you can't keep it without giving it away. How true it is. In the beginning, I thought I had to say all the right things and save everyone. Today, I realize I only have what's in my heart to share. Today, I can walk into a meeting, and if I'm full of the Father's love, then I share it. And yet, there are times I walk into a meeting and want to throw the coffee pot through the window. Yet I have to stay honest, for that's the way I stay clean. I know today that staying clean and having a relationship with God as I understand Him is the most important thing in my life. When I do that and carry the message to the ones who still suffer, then all else is provided in my life. I really believe that I don't have to prove anything to anyone. I carry the message by letting the newcomer know who I am inside and sharing how I work the steps one day at a time. Since getting clean in 1971, life has been anything but boring. I have traveled all over. My sponsor was an example of following your heart, and wherever we went, NA was alive. Our houses were always open with a coffee pot going. We started meetings wherever we arrived. Sometimes we had no money, but we went out to do our primary purpose, and God always showed us the way. My sponsor died 3 years ago with 18 years clean. Most of the group has family now, and we're scattered around the United States learning different lessons. Yet NA always comes first. Today I am married and pursue different things than during the first 7 years of my recovery. Yet I know the only way I can have any outside gifts is to put the program and God first. We really have found a way up and out. And so long as we keep giving it away, no matter if it is love and joy or tears and fears, it will be all right. Today I live because people are there who care and will listen. I really believe in magic, for my life is full of it. God is loving us now.
This is where you introduce your sponsor, Bob.
Now I'd like to introduce the author of this beautiful story, this magical story in our basic text. It's very near and dear to my heart, and it's probably, if not my best friend. I'd like to introduce Mr. Tom C.
Aloha. I'm Tom, a very grateful addict. Thank you, Bob. That was very loving of you to do for me. You know, I'm a little bit embarrassed to tell you that several times due to listening to that story, I started to cry, but I guess that's what's real, you know? What's real is it was really an insane life before I found Narcotics Anonymous. Since the Zoom thing has started, I've been going to a lot more meetings all over the place, different parts of the world, all these workshops they've been doing, the history, you know, a lot of history stuff. We did the history of the basic text. And I guess I was right in the middle of the, you know, the beginning of a lot of stuff. If I would have known that that was going to be history someday, maybe I would have paid more attention or something to what was going on. But, you know, how my story even got in the basic text is to me, kind of, it's nice, you know, but I was asked to speak at this convention in Atlanta, Georgia, and I think it was 1978 or 9. It was the 9th World NA Convention. So some of you probably know what year that was. It was either 78 or 79, but I was asked to speak there. So I did, I went and did exactly that. And then somewhere, that's where I met this group of people during that weekend that were working on the basic text, you know, and they asked me to write out my story and send it in. So I did, and kind of like I think Charles said, write it out, hand it in here. And I just kind of forgot about it. I mean, I didn't even know what really the consequences of having your story and the basic text would be. I did it just anyway. All of a sudden, boom! There it is. I'm in the basic text. So that's been a privilege from right up to now. It's not like it's changed a lot. You know, my life is about, you know, learning to give and get out of self. That's what it's always been since the Flowbird, since I met that lady Flowbird. It's always been about, you know, putting others before me, learning to do that. That's not easy, you know. So anyway, it's been fun having my story in the basic text, actually, without ego in the way or anything. You know, I kind of giggle. I love it, you know. I think my story even made it to the 6th edition, but, you know, like I've been speaking a lot on Zoom, and the other day, wherever I spoke, the guy sent out a bulletin, don't miss tonight, Tom C. from Hawaii, stories in the basic text. You know, I just kind of giggle. I love it. You know, I kind of giggle, and it's definitely an honor to be part of the literature of Narcotics Anonymous. And, I was on the committee also that wrote How It Works and Why, and there's a part in our sponsor, this lady, she used to always say, do you know what God's will is? And everybody would come up with some groovy, esoteric answer, you know, and then she would just laugh and say, God's will for us is to live, love, laugh, and be happy. It's just that simple, she would say. Go do that and go give it away every day. Anyway, so I was on the committee writing the How It Works and Why, and we would do all our work on a weekend. I'd fly in on a Thursday from Hawaii and then leave on a Sunday. But we'd do all this work, you know, writing, a group of us, some from the office, just some like me picked to be of service. And so I really wanted I was kind of the airy-fairy guy on the group anyway. They'd say, okay, Tom, here, what's the spiritual principle on this step, you know, or whatever. But I really wanted to get that live, love, laugh, and be happy in the book, you know. So I said, I wrote that out and said some stuff, and then we went home and came back. And they, of course, you can see live, love, laugh, and be happy in the paragraph they wrote. And I think it's a paragraph that is a lot of people's favorite, probably your favorite, and you didn't even know how it got there, but because I think it's the second to the last paragraph or something in the 11th step. It's one, it talks about having dignity and, you know, not having to have any money or anything, you know, just work. I don't know it word for word now, but I'm sure you know which one, but that's in there, and it's lovely that we got some stuff like that. But anyway, so my life today is different, of course. I mean, it's always changing. What I do for spiritual practice now is different than it was 10 years ago, but it's still spiritual practice, right? And, you know, I might even be going through tougher stuff in my later recovery. I've got 49 years clean, and I'm 76 years old, and I've been with my wife for 35 years. So I'm kind of like an old timer in all areas of my life, you know. And but I don't have it together. I'm so far away from having it together. It's incredible. It's actually beautiful because it makes me be a beginner every day. I'm a newcomer, and every day I'm a beginner, and I have to pay attention, and I have to have I have to reach for humility and do that stuff. So it's been a beautiful thing, you know. And so I feel pretty lucky to have somebody like, although Flaubert died before I got in the basic text, because it was right around the same time she died in 78. And I went to Georgia in 78, I think, or 79. So anyway, I always try to honor her whenever I speak at conventions or do anything. And like in the basic text, you know, with the stories and stuff like that, because my life, I didn't know how much my life was going to change when I went to that first meeting, you know. And what's ironic is I usually share this, what brought me back to my second meeting wasn't that I was in a room full of people that used the way I did and they were now clean and stuff like that. That was beautiful. That was part of that first meeting. But what really brought me back to the second meeting was this guy shared that night at the meeting that he shared about his fears. He shared about how separated he felt from life. And really, I'd never heard anybody else share that. I thought I was the only one. And I had those feelings since my mom dropped me off at nursery school, you know. I walked in and I knew everybody in the classroom had it together and I didn't. I knew all of you in the classroom understood what the teacher was talking about and I didn't, you know. That's the disease of separation, and that's the disease of addiction. If I would have known when I was that young in the first grade and everything that I could take a sock and take the glue, we were gluing pictures in and doing all our little crafts and stuff. If I could have taken that glue and put it in my sock and started sniffing it right then, I would have, because it would have taken away this incredible isolation that I felt. So I love, you know, the second step where, you know, they talk about this insanity, and I really think the insanity is the separation. It's when I'm either in recovery, being intimate with God and people, or I'm in the disease, feeling separated from God and people. And that's the way I look at it. It's my barometer. When I'm feeling that, and believe me, even with 49 years clean, I feel separated sometimes, you know. One thing I can tell you for sure from working the steps over and over and over again, and I really have worked them so many times, that even with all that work that I've done and the service I've tried to get and be available for, my character defects still are stalking me. My character defects and shortcomings still stalk me to this day. You know, I don't get, it's just like, it's just like we don't ever get clean forever, right? We're clean one day at a time, and that's contingent on me going through a profound personality change again and again and again and again, not just once, again and again and again, you know. And that's how I stay clean, and that's how I try to live a life of freedom and not be separated, you know. But it's there, but it keeps me on the ball. You know, I love addiction because I think we're so lucky in a sense to have this deadly addiction, because we can't sit on the fence. We can't sit on the fence and say, oh, wait, I'll do this stuff, or I'll learn to, you know, give of myself, or I'll learn to think of others instead of me. No, we can't even do that. We have to jump full on into this spiritual life and make it and be available for it to work our lives, you know. And that's what I love about it. You know, and it started because that guy went and saw Carl Jung one time in the early 30s, before any of this 12-step stuff, anything, before the other fellowship. This guy like me and you, you know, hopeless, dying inside, feeling so isolated and separated and not wanting to use anymore, but couldn't stop. This guy found his way to Carl Jung and spent time with Carl Jung, you know, who was very famous then and very famous now after his death. But Carl Jung, after working with the guy for a while, he just finally said he had the insight. He had the beautiful insight what to do. And what he did is he told the guy the truth. I can't help you. I can't help you. This is hopelessness, and I can't change it for you. But he said in a few rare incidences, I've seen people change that have gone, that have gone through a profound personality change brought on by a spiritual experience. That meeting, that day, those words are the big bang of the 12 steps. That's what started it. That's the big bang of our life. That's why we're still alive, because we have this stuff to do, to work with, you know? So I'm just so grateful for it. And I got to tell you, you know, being an NA and being clean a long time and doing all that stuff, it's a beautiful thing. But, you know, I didn't get a gold star. None of us get a gold star on our heart for doing this stuff. You know, we stay clean another day is what we do, you know? What I found out is that I got to stay clean when it makes no sense. You know what I mean? There's times when it makes no sense to stay clean. And I stayed clean through those times. That's why I have 49 years now, because I've stayed clean when it made no sense. And that'll happen. We are blessed to be given challenges. We dive deep in it within. It forces us to dive deep within each challenge that comes along. I think somebody was talking about health. I don't know if it was Bob or Carl I don't know. But, you know, I've gone through health stuff too, and I'm still am, you know. At one time, I was always saying I'm the healthiest. Because look at, I was a vegetarian since 1966, you know, and I was a marathon runner. I ran 50 miles on my 50th birthday, and I rode 60 and rode 70 on my 60 and 70th on my bike. So I've always gone and, you know, been a vegetarian for so long. You know, I've always said I'm the healthiest guy on the planet. And my wife used to say, Tom, you know, nobody else really feels that way about you, you know, that you're the healthiest guy on the planet. Because I had already had cancer. I had had an auto accident that put me unconscious, and they sent me home afterwards, said I was okay. And I started having weird experiences. You know, I would dial the phone and put it down and walk away. One time I was walking through the living room and I went and spit right on the living room floor. I was getting kind of weird, you know. I was in a lot of pain. My head was killing me. And my wife's a psychologist, and she said, you know, something's definitely wrong. We got to send you back. And they sent me to have an MRI and on Oahu. And after the MRI, they took me in the wheelchair and rushed me right upstairs. And I got out of the elevator, and there it says neural science, you know, neural surgery. They took, you know, and this neurosurgeon came out and said, how did you get here? And I had said I had flown over in a plane and then drove my car, because I had a car on Oahu too. And I drove my car here. And he goes, you know, I have to tell you, you should be dead. You shouldn't be able to talk. And your brain has been bleeding for 3 months. That was what was the matter after that total car accident, me going unconscious. I was bleeding. They didn't catch it in the first 10 minutes that they look at you. And he said, we have to submit you to the hospital right now, today. You have to go into surgery, you know. So that resulted in 2 surgeries to get the blood out, you know, and just the accident itself was trauma to my brain. Just each surgery was trauma to my brain. You know, having the blood in there for 3 months was trauma to my brain. And then, so I always thought he told me, he says, once you get out of here, you know, you can look at the next 2 years as being how good you're going to get afterwards. And so anyway, I'm just sharing that because I'm not the healthiest guy in the world. I got in another accident a few months ago. That was 2006, the other one, and I hadn't been in one since. But I got in another one where I told about my new car. And so I don't drive anymore, by the way. I can't afford any more accidents, you know, because now that was brain trauma. And that almost was like an instant setting off a bunch of signals in my brain, you know. So I'm dealing with brain trauma, you know, now from now till the day I leave the body, you know, and I'm doing some really beautiful work with deep meditation. Because look, I'm a mindfulness guy, you know what I mean? Mindfulness meditation. You know, I'm going to get all hung up. Somebody better tell me when to hang up here. But anyway, that's what I'm dealing with now, and I will be dealing with it, you know, and I don't know how bad it'll get. But what's going to be interesting is I'm a mindfulness guy. I meditate every day. Every day I bring myself back to the present moment all day long, maybe 10,000 times a day. I have to come back to the moment, come back to the moment. It's just like taking a third step right in the middle of the day. You just come back to the moment, you know, get out of the storyline. Whatever I'm thinking isn't real, you know. So I get out of the storyline. So, but, you know, I'm 76, you know, and the brain's getting weird anyway. So anyway, I'm still okay to speak. I'm still remember my story. So that's a beautiful thing. And that's so anyway, look at. I learned how to meditate, which I think is very important for everyone to do. And when I met Flo Bird, and she actually did meditate every day for 2 or 3 hours and write in a journal and then go. That's how we traveled so much. That's how she moved into the house next door to me. She was led in meditation. So I believe that can be a real thing for all of us, you know. And so I get up every morning and sit, you know. And I write, I don't write in a journal anymore, but I document anything that comes through. Every significant thing I've been through, oh, I got to stop, see. Anyway, that's beautiful. I just want to thank you all for letting me share it. And thanks, Francis, for doing this again. I've done it with you before or something.
You still anyway, have 5 minutes, Tom.
Oh, 5 minutes, huh? Well, I better not take it because I've already...
Okay.
I'll shut down. I'll shut down now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
I love you.
Thank you so much.